90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. I am Adam Horowitz. In this episode, we will be discussing elections. On March 23rd, Israel held its fourth national election in 2 years. And starting in May, Palestinians in the occupied territory will be holding their first elections in 15 years. Both elections will serve as a referendum on the current leaders, and both will undoubtedly give us insight into what the future may hold, both for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation and perhaps Palestinians worldwide. In our first discussion, Mondo Weiss founder and senior editor Phil Weiss talks with the Israeli human rights activist and blogger Yossi Gurwitz to unpack the results of the Israeli election and to discuss what comes next.
Hi, Yossi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate your coming on to share your insights today on a pretty important day. And how are you doing?
Calm, I think. This is, you know, that was, the results were well within the expected results. I'm not surprised either way.
I stayed up late to watch Netanyahu give his speech at 2:30 in the morning, your time. And at that time, the exit polls were saying that it wasn't a clear path to victory for either side, the anti-Netanyahu parties or Netanyahu's right-wing bloc, but that it appeared that Netanyahu has the easier path. Can you update us on all that and where we are and whether there is any sort of definitive reading from either the exit polls or the returns now in Israel?
Okay, first thing first, the semifinal results will be delivered on Friday. They're not final, but they will give us the a much better look at how many seats each party will have. At the moment, things have changed from last night. At the moment, and this is with after the counting of 87.8% of the votes, the anti-Netanyahu bloc has 61 seats, while the pro-Netanyahu bloc has 59. So technically, it's a majority for the anti-Netanyahu bloc, but this bloc is fractured along several lines, and I don't think it will manage to create a stable coalition.
To be clear, the pro-Netanyahu bloc, are you including Yamina in that 15?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And where is Ram? Did Ram make the threshold there?
Ram, according to the latest information, has cleared the goal and now has 5 seats.
If those results hold, I assume that Yesh Atid and Yair Lapid would be the second largest vote getter. Would, given that the 61 exists on that side, does that mean that Rivlin would ask Lapid to try to form a coalition first? Or tell me how things would work and tell me whether there is any possibility of that 61 knocking out Netanyahu by your estimation.
Well, Rivlin will consult with the leaders of each party and will ask each party to nominate a prime minister. And this time he will press them. He has semi-officially said so. He will not allow them to any wiggle room. They will have to provide a prime minister. I don't see how the 61 current anti-Netanyahu bloc will be able to provide one. The bloc contains both nationalist parties and the joint list. Several parties, including Sa'a, have already said publicly they will not sit with Meretz in a coalition, and certainly not with a joint list. So this is a stumbling block, and I don't see how they can get over it. It's not something the voters will take lightly, especially not Sa'a's voters. In the same time, Netanyahu has publicly said he is going to collect deserters from other parties. Again, Saar's party seems to be the most fragile at the moment. So presumably, Netanyahu can collect 2 or 3 deserters and somehow create a coalition. Then again, it will not. It will be extremely, extremely hard for him, as his coalition is also fissile and it contains the Zionist Religious Party, which is an amalgamation of several extreme right groups. Many of them hate each other, and some of them are particularly Ben-Gvir's Kahanists, have a long history of, throwing Molotov cocktails at coalitions. So they will not be easy partners in any way. They will have to maintain their extremism, and they will therefore have to demand things that Netanyahu cannot simply allow to happen. At the moment, I think the most likely scenario is a fifth round of elections.
First, I don't know exactly the numbers here. How many did religious Zionism get? How many seats did they get by the latest count?
6 seats.
And how many did Meretz get?
5.
And Labor?
Labor got 7.
So we see this right-wing racist party, which includes Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. the
and
religious
now part. And now also Noam, which right. is an extremely, even by Smotrich standards, mm-hmm. right-wing religious party. Their main issue is homophobia. Mm-hmm. They're quite strong on it.
Mm-hmm. Yair Lapid was talking about a racist and homophobic coalition that Netanyahu was forming. He was referring specifically to Noam and to Ben-Gvir and Smotrich.
Yeah, because during the last few days of the campaign, Netanyahu did everything he could to make certain that the National Religious Party would cross the threshold.
And he succeeded.
He was trying everything he could to do to break Bennett. I think he succeeded because in last week's polls, Bennett had 11 seats or 13 seats, depending on the poll. And now he has 7.
I want to get to the bigger picture, and because we're a little bit Americans may not understand these numbers so well, but we're talking about these smaller parties and some sort of juggernaut parties that were thought to be real kingmakers or players in this that have sort of risen and fallen over the last few weeks. One of them was Gideon Saar's party breaking away from Likud. And at times, Gideon Saar was seen as the next great hope of right-wing politics in Israel, and was polling, his party was polling as high as, I think, 16 or 17 seats. Yeah. And it faded in the end. I don't know where they landed, but explain why Saar is also, and now you say that Saar's party, Netanyahu, is going to try to cannibalize Saar's party, which was an anti-Netanyahu party. He's going to try to cannibalize that party in order to get over the 61. Where did Saar's party land, and why did it collapse in the manner that it did?
Basically, Saar is possibly the least charismatic politician in Israel. And people were supporting him in the hope he would break Netanyahu. Saar was a rival within Likud. Netanyahu ate him up and basically almost threw him out of the party. So finally, Saar left the party, created his own. At the last moment, and we don't know why, at least not yet, it seems many of Saar's voters decided to go back to where they came from originally, which is blue-white. Blue-white was supposed to be wiped out, and at the moment, it has 8 seats. Nobody foresaw. People said they will either not cross the threshold or cross it by a small margin. Apparently, they ran a very good campaign.
Yossi, I'm about to ask you for the bigger picture to explain what all this means in terms of Israeli society, whether we can say anything about how right-wing, how left-wing, what the state of the left is, what the state of the right is. That's the big picture here. But before one more drill-down question. Mm-hmm. Is there any possibility that because there is this deadlock, is there any chance that the rotation, and given blue and white's strong showing, is there any chance that the rotation agreement, which was the kind of unity deal that came out of the last election between Benny Gantz and a blue and white and Benjamin Netanyahu, is there any chance that that rotation agreement will be revived by Rivlin and say, this is how you can, and that Gantz would again fold into the Netanyahu camp? And
Here's a curious legal loophole. They basically changed the basic government law. And they wrote into the law a date in November this year by which Benny Gantz will become prime minister. Now, technically, if Benny Gantz lives and is a member of Knesset by that date, according to law, he will be prime minister. So if I were Gantz, what I would try to do is stall, steal some time, get a new election in July or August, then run on the premise that after the elections, he will automatically become prime minister.
Why?
This is a curveball. Nobody knows what it will happen. Nobody knows whether it will survive a challenge in the High Court of Justice. But this is a possibility. And if I were Gantz, that's what I would aim at.
And just to be clear, he can't do that with the current election results. He couldn't do that stall. You have to form a government now, and he won't go in with Netanyahu to form a new government.
All he has to do is wait for Netanyahu not to fail at forming a government. Failing that, he would say that it's a nice government you've got here. I've got a law, and you know how now you have to change the basic law again and face another challenge in the High Court of Justice. Let's see if you can do that. And then somehow survive to November.
Do you assign that possibility any type of likelihood? What do you think the chances are of that, of Benny Gantz playing his card so well are?
Remote. He's one of the least capable politicians the nation has ever seen. But if everyone else fails at forming a government, this might actually work. I think it would be a disgrace because, you know, that's not what the voters wanted in any way. That's basically, there was a new election. There has to be a new government. The earlier Knesset is gone. This shouldn't have any importance. But they rammed it through into a basic law. And now changing it, that was why Gantz agreed to join the government. He said, look, I'm going to force Netanyahu to take him at his word because I'm shackling him to the new basic law. And now we're all going to have to live with this disaster.
One more detailed question before we get to the big picture. The Ram passed the threshold more than, you say, and has five seats, the Islamist Palestinian Party. Mm-hmm. And the joint list ended up with 7 or 8. Is that correct?
6.
So the joint list from having 15 seats in last May's election has gone down to the two components, Ram and the joint list, have together, the Palestinian parties are now at 11. Is that correct?
That's correct, assuming the number stands.
And where is Ram on, what's the latest on whether Ram would be part of a Netanyahu governing coalition?
Mansour Abbas, the leader of the party, said that during the night, first he said, we are going to pass the threshold, and they did. And then he said, we are not a part of any bloc. We will act as we deem fit.
And what does that mean?
It means he's going to extract a very high price from anyone who is trying to form a coalition. He has already agreed to meet with Lapid later this week. And Lapid, a few weeks ago, wouldn't touch him with a 10-foot pole.
So Lapid, as this, we began this discussion by your telling me that Lapid has 61 seats, ostensibly, in anti-Netanyahu potential coalition.
No, actually, Lapid is basically the one person who cannot become prime minister.
Okay.
He has acknowledged that. He said he is willing to be a coalition partner in any coalition that will replace Netanyahu, but he will not seek the prime ministership himself.
Okay.
He knows he has too many enemies.
You've given me a scenario by which Benny Gantz might replace Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. Is there any other scenario by which a centrist or a right winger would replace Netanyahu, given those that there's rich material in anti-Netanyahu force constituency? You have 61 seats and you have Ram, so that's 66 total. Is that correct?
No, so Ram would be part of the 61.
Oh, okay. So is there any other scenario you can give us by which Netanyahu would be replaced? You've given us the scenario by which Gantz would do it. Is there any way that Saar or, I can't imagine Lieberman, but you've said Lapid can't do it. Is there any way that, who else could replace Netanyahu?
Well, basically, I think they were thinking Saar when he was supposed to have 11, 13 seats. Uh-huh. Now he has 6 and possibly 5. So it's not feasible for a party of 5 seats to claim the prime ministership. It can't happen.
I see.
He wouldn't have the votes to uh-huh. run his own government.
I see.
So basically, Netanyahu has an advantage here because his party is supposed to have 30 seats, 31 maybe, and he will have an easier way of forming a government. Mm. I think Lieberman might be able to do it. God save us all. And since Gantz has 8 seats now, which is more than Lieberman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Lieberman has 7?
Has 7, yeah. So Gantz may attempt to create a coalition. Will anyone actually talk to him? Is a good question. Basically, like I said, there's a 61 block, but it's too fractured to hold.
Is there any way that Reuven Rivlin, the president of Israel, who is the one who, you know, helps broker these agreements, right? Is there any way that Rivlin would knock heads together and say, damn it, you are making Israel an international farce in terms of democracy with 4 elections in under 2 years. Get over these differences and take out Netanyahu, get rid of Netanyahu. You have enough and put Benny Gantz, you know, is there any way he could say Lapid, Gantz, Saar, get it together. Together, Lieberman, together you have, 45 seats or whatever with Labor and Meretz, 55, and you see where I'm going. Is there any way that Rivlin could effect such a deal?
He could. Peres certainly would have, but doing so would be considered violating his oath of office, and I don't see Rivlin doing that. He's very strictly a man of honor. So he may nudge people, but he will not, you know, put him in the room and say, that's what we're going to do. That's not what a president does. So I don't see that happening. I can see him giving the first chance to whomever the anti-Netanyahu coalition thinks of. There was speculation that if Bennett joins the anti-Netanyahu bloc, while there's a tacit agreement that the joint list will stay out of the coalition but not vote against it, then there will be a 54 block bigger than the Netanyahu block which can sustain a coalition. I don't what everyone is saying is sustain a coalition until Netanyahu's trial gets into real action. Once that begins, all you have to do is survive a few more months. Let the courts do their job, and then once he is removed as a political power, dissolve the coalition. But this is a nightmare coalition. It couldn't do anything. It couldn't pass a budget. If it can't pass a budget, it's automatically dissolved.
That would be 54 plus 11 outside Palestinian parties as an outside voting bloc. Is that correct?
Yes, which means this is a nightmare scenario. I mean... This would be a headless government with someone who's coming from a party with 6 or 7 seats, which will have to fight daily for its existence. And that's not even mentioning the possibility of, you know, a capital scenario.
I don't know what that means.
Massive right-wing mobs storming the
capital. Oh, I see. Yossi, it's 25 minutes. I told you I'd keep you for 20 this morning. I want you to conclude by an election is a picture of a society. What does this election tell you about where Israel is? I want your sort of sum up. I've been peppering you with questions, keeping you from making any sort of grand statement at all or grand explanation. And so please, can you interpret this election? Can you give me a bottom line and picture of where Israel is?
Ansel Pfeffer wrote something in Ares today. I think it would be translated into English, and I think he hit the nail on the head. He said, basically, the Knesset now contains 20 seats of racist, Jewish supremacist parties, and they're coming into their own, and they're not going anywhere. If in the past they were masquerading or they failed to pass the threshold That's no longer the case. We have Smotrich, Ben Gvir, and Noam in the Knesset now. And since the Orthodox parties, Shas and Yadut HaTorah, were forced to fight against this party because at least one seat or two seats of the Religious Nationalist Party come from ultra-Orthodox voters, the Orthodox parties had to become more extreme. Yadut HaTorah published for the first time, and that's a bit historical here, a manifest saying they are a right-wing party. They will not support any withdrawals from the West Bank. They support Netanyahu. They're a right-wing party now. That's, you know, lifting some veils of the country. The revanchist right and the, I wouldn't say fascist because they're not, but and not populist either. The Volkish is coming into its own. What matters is if you're a Jew, and not much else does. That was an underground movement for a few decades now, but now it's on the surface.
And just to be clear, this means you were talking about religious Zionism with its six or seven seats. You're talking about Shas and UTJ in that. Now UTJ, Shas has always been right wing in that sense, right? And then you would include Bennett too. I want to understand how large a faction this is.
I would say that would be UTJ, United Torah Judaism, Shas, and Religious Zionism. I'm not sure Bennett will go that way because he was going out of his way to gather secular voters. And he always had problems with rabbis as a force in politics. They never liked him, and he never liked them. He has, you know, he's wearing what we call, as a derogative, a delinquent's yarmulke, a very small yarmulke that criminals wear in court.
There were signs that the center was going to oppose this folkish element in Israeli politics in this election. Yair Lapid, Benny Gantz, I guess even Saar, leave alone the left, which is opposed to these politics, that these centrists said, we do not want an Israel that is so intolerant. Do you see that as any, that the Volkish will be met by a center, more secular center, that's going to say, no, this is not the future of Israel?
To quote Yates, the center cannot hold. The center has no strong beliefs either way. Saar is not centrist. Saar is a harsh right wingman. He persecuted the African refugees like no other minister did. He was one of the main supporters of the nationality law. He was always to the right of Likud. Lapid, Lieberman has no convictions. During this election campaign, he denounced his own support for the nationality law, presumably because it was getting voters. Lapid, you know, he dislikes the Volkish element, but that's because they're unseemly. They look bad on camera. And what's important to Lapid and much of the center is how things look. They want to present a nice face to the world, particularly now with the ICC breathing down their necks. And the Volkish elements are going to make this very, very difficult.
In the near term or also in the long term?
Oh, wow. You know, we've been having four elections in 2 years. I'm not sure I can actually predict any long term. But I think that the threshold has been crossed here. Once the Volkish element actually got into the Knesset, which they didn't manage to do since Kahana in 1984, I don't see them losing their seats. I think a threshold has been crossed. Some element of shame is removed, and I think they're now a fixture. I could be totally wrong, okay? Uh-huh. This is... I have no idea what will happen in the next election. I have no idea when the next election will take place. But I think they're here to stay.
who is the next prime minister of Israel, and what is your degree of sorrow, depression, demoralization right now, Yossi? What's your mood about all this?
Actually, I'm quite pleased. Meretz survived, which was not a given. Labor basically reinvented itself and went from zero seats in the polls when it all started to seven seats. I think Mirav Mikhaeli is the new leader of the left. That's not precisely good news because she acknowledged she does not want to talk about the occupation. Uh-huh. But they're basically, she's a very elegant and eloquent speaker, uh-huh, and she can get people around her. And once she proved she can do that, because it was not at all clear she could, I think that we will slowly see over the next few elections elements of old labor coming back home. This will mean shrinkage of blue-white, shrinkage of Yesh Atid, possibly something more coherent that a future anti-Netanyahu coalition can rely on. I have no expectations of Saar, no expectations of Lieberman, and very low expectations of Lapid. Once again, because this coalition can't hold. Mm-hmm. There are too many opposing elements in it. So, to sum, Netanyahu will be prime minister because he is the current prime minister, mm-hmm, until he will be unseated either in the next polls or by being convicted in court. And, of course, unless the strange vision of Gantz getting into office by law in November actually happens. I think this law is going to cause many people a lot of headaches in the coming weeks. They will have to, you know, fix it. I don't think they have the votes. So this is going to be one nightmare scenario.
Well, Yossi, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate your insights. And I thank you for your time. And I wish you the best.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh,
Al-Shabaka senior analyst Dr. Yara Hawari about Palestinian politics and whether democratic elections are even possible under Israeli occupation.
The upcoming Palestinian elections came somewhat as a surprise to many Palestinians who have been waiting, you know, for more than 14 years now for the chance to exercise their right to vote. Many people argue that a large part of the motivation behind Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's choosing to hold the elections now has to do with his desire to gain more legitimacy for the PA on the international stage, particularly in front of the new U.S. administration. From your understanding, could you just give us some more insight into what sort of the main motivators were behind holding the elections now, and how much influence did international and regional players have in that decision?
Yeah, of course. I think there's been, you know, both external and internal pressures on both Abbas and the PA itself to have elections, not just presidential, but also legislative council elections. The internal pressures come from civil society, which has been quite vocal in their opposition to the lack of the PA's democratic mandate, but also internal people within Fatah and within the various political factions who perhaps it would be to give them too much credit to say that they're concerned about the lack of democracy, but also, you know, I think an important point to note is that they also have their own interests and they want their own piece of the pie. And the external pressures, of course, come from the donor community. The international donor community spend a lot of money on the Palestinian Authority, and it becomes increasingly, as every year goes by without elections, it becomes increasingly more difficult to justify that money. You know, at the end of the day, this is a regime that is well past its electoral mandate over a decade, past its electoral mandate, and the same goes for the for President Abbas. And it becomes a sort of a source of embarrassment for the donor community. Now, all of this is to say that we're still, you know, not 100% sure that these elections will go ahead. They have gone further than any other sort of calls for elections in the past. There has, you know, been a registration period. We have actual dates. But more recently, various analysts and commentators have been now wondering if they will go ahead at all because of the sort of various barriers, political, but also, you know, sort of circumstantial barriers because of the pandemic. So we're still not 100% sure that these will take place.
You know, speaking of the different sort of internal barriers that are already starting to come up, last week, the Fatah Central Committee announced that the party would be running as one list in the elections. And there have been reports that Abbas has, you know, essentially threatened that any Fatah official who runs outside the faction's official list would be punished. Other political factions have called on Abbas as well to hold a national meeting to agree on, you know, different issues before the election. And that's something that he's also refused to do so far. And it's seeming increasingly likely that Abbas and the PA might go ahead with the elections via presidential decree, as you said, if they do in fact go through. With the current trends that, you know, you're seeing and the way that some of the lists are already being decided within the ruling party of the PA, you know, do you think that these elections can truly be described as democratic and representing the hopes and desires of the Palestinian people? You know, what are these elections in their current form actually offering to the Palestinian people in terms of change and in terms of something new?
Well, in a very sort of quick answer to that question, I don't think that they offer much, and I don't think that they are a manifestation of democracy. An important point that I didn't mention in the sort of in the previous question, that these elections are also assigned to the Biden administration, right? The PA has not, you know, with the Trump administration was totally marginalized and had no seat at the table. And so this is also a sign to the Biden administration that they're now ready to play ball and to set the table with the grown-ups. And so with all of that in mind, and the sort of the other factors that I mentioned, I think, you know, this, these elections do not come at, from a place of, you know, real will for sort of democracy, democratic practice. They don't come from a place of really wanting to give Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza that opportunity to express themselves democratically. And so this is very much political theatrics. And whilst that might be said of all, you know, all elections, indeed, you know, all around the world, ruling parties call for general elections at very strategic moments. So, you know, it's not necessarily an anomaly in Palestine. But what is different here is that this is not a democratic context. There isn't space for free space for democratic expression. The fact that these elections were called so quickly and with such little time for people to prepare is, you know, just is one demonstrates that very well. It's a repressive political atmosphere. You know as well as I do that journalists, activists, students are routinely arrested by the Palestinian security forces for voicing political opposition, routinely harassed. There's a lot of like online censorship going on. There really isn't that space for totally free democratic practice. Now, some might argue that Palestinian civil society is strong and it's, you know, it does voice opposition, and that is a sign of a democratic society, so it can't be that bad. But Palestinian civil society, NGOs and organizations cannot replace political parties. The NGOs and civil societies can't be that sort of substitute political opposition. Yeah. And that's what's happened, unfortunately. And so it provides this great smoke screen that actually, well, you know, there is democratic practice in Palestine because of the existence of the civil society, but that's not the case. And the political institution knows that very well.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, you know, how these elections could essentially benefit the PA and show that they're ready to, you know, be taken seriously and sit at the table with the US administration, et cetera. But how would these elections also serve to, you know, more personally benefit Abbas and sort of the upper echelons of the PA, both at home and abroad? What would sort of the repercussions of having these elections now be in terms of those specific players?
So many have described these elections really as a sort of a power sharing agreement between the powers that be, the powers that already exist, the elites that already run the show. And I think that is true. I think, you know, they wouldn't call for elections if there was a real challenge to their dominance. And, you know, Abbas being announced as the sort of official Fatah candidate just really sums everything up. You know, he's been president for a decade and a half. He rules increasingly by presidential decrees, which lack any kind of accountability or representational or present any representational voice. And I think that just, you know, that sums him up and his character and the way that he governs. It sums it up very well. And so I don't think that they would call the elections if they thought there was any real challenge to that. I think they are surprised by the sort of the internal grumblings within Fatah. We've heard a lot about different potential candidates, different sort of breakaway lists, people really unhappy within Fatah that Abbas is running again. And perhaps they weren't as prepared as they should have been for that. So it will be interesting to see how the next few months sort of evolve internally and with, you know, the various different lists. But I think something that's important to note is that this is not, if the elections do go ahead, this is not going to be like any sort of usual election campaign or run up to general elections, because of course there is the pandemic. And whilst a lot of places are sort of, you know, opening up and seeing their populations being vaccinated, the West Bank and Gaza has gone under a renewed lockdown, one that is very reminiscent of the one that was imposed a year ago. People, the schools and universities have been closed, shops have been closed, people are not allowed to drive in the streets, walk outside of their neighborhoods. So this, you know, really begs the question of, you know, is this a conducive space for elections? How do people mobilize? I mean, already there isn't that democratic space to do so freely. Mm-hmm. Already it was a very tight space, and now it's even tighter yet, especially because the main areas of traditional political mobilization, such as universities and workspaces, have been shut down. So there are a lot of questions still to be had. I mean, we have, you know, quite a few weeks away before the elections are supposed to take place, the first elections at mid to end of May, mm-hmm. and then later the presidential elections at the end of July. So there's still time for things to change, but there are a lot of unknowns that I don't think we can answer at the moment.
Another major point of contention, you know, for these elections has been the inclusion of Palestinians living in occupied East Jerusalem and Palestinians living in the diaspora. Until now, Israel is still refusing to allow the participation of Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And the PA has said that the elections wouldn't include the millions of Palestinians in the diaspora. My question is, how is it possible, you know, to hold, you know, real fair elections that can bring about significant change in these conditions? And what kind of, you know, democracy is really possible under the constraints of, you know, the ongoing Israeli military occupation?
That's a very good question. And the short answer is that you cannot have a democracy under Israeli military occupation. And the reason for that is because Israel doesn't want to see a true flourishing Palestinian democracy. And it, you know, we see that demonstrated by the fact that they constantly arrest activists and political, you know, figures. The Israeli prisons are full of thousands of political prisoners. And so if political activities, mobilizations are punished by the Israeli regime, how can you expect for that to sort of translate into a Palestinian democracy, not to mention all the sort of infrastructural and sort of real material barriers that they put in the way, such as the deliberate fragmentation of the Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza and beyond. You know, this is something that's not being talked about much, is the sort of very nitty-gritty aspects of elections, the very real aspects. You know, where do the polling stations go? How do people, Palestinians in Area C, get to polling stations when presumably the Israelis won't allow the PA to set up polling stations in Area C? How will Palestinians in East Jerusalem vote if there aren't, if the Israelis are forbidding them to set up polling stations in East Jerusalem? Will they have to go to the West Bank to vote? And if they vote in the West Bank, will they be at risk of losing their permanent residency? Because the Israeli regime might choose to punish mm-hmm. East Jerusalemites who vote in PA elections. And that's not to mention, you know, the diaspora community, all the Palestinian citizens of Israel who are not at all going to be represented in these elections, even though there is a call for Palestinian National Council elections at the end of the summer, in which all Palestinians are supposed to be represented in that body. There is no, you know, there haven't been any moves to sort of to make that happen. There's been no registration of Palestinians in the diaspora. There's so many barriers in the way, and I'll be very interested to see how the PA attempts to address these. From what I've seen so far, they really aren't doing the best job at it.
If these elections, you know, do go through and the current status quo within the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership is essentially just upheld and reinforced, what are the long-term effects that could have on Palestinian society and, you know, the larger struggle for Palestinian liberation? Would you consider that to just be another, you know, setback for however many years into the future? Or, you know, what can you say about that as the long-term effects?
I think this, you know, this is, these elections have the potential to set the Palestinian people back a lot. I mean, if you look when the last elections were held over a decade and a half ago, it sort of gave a legitimacy for the current ruling regime to continue for as long as it has done without elections. So is this going to give whoever, you know, another 15 years of life? Is it going to give Abbas, you know, sort of just more legitimacy to do what he wants to do and then to sort of prop up a successor? So there are all these, you know, big overarching questions. But I think it's also a distraction technique. You know, people, we can't shy away from the fact that people are excited about the elections. You know, there was a high registration, even though it's important to note that, you know, the PA is really promoting the high registration percentage. I think it's 93%. Many of those were registered from the last time they voted. But there is an air of sort of interest, at least we can say, and that's because it's a novelty. It is a novelty for a lot of people, a lot of Palestinians. The majority of Palestinians are young people. They have not ever had the chance to vote. So this, you know, this is a novelty. It's something new. And it's really sad because I think a lot of people's hopes will be crushed. I think that the sort of, the initial excitement around it soon will be crushed. And I think it will have long lasting effects on Palestinian society. And it's, you know, it's really is wasted energies, I think, to focus on this kind of election in this kind of atmosphere.
I want to finish off with a question for you, you know, as a member of the Palestinian youth. What do you think needs to be done in order to have or open up a space for meaningful democracy in Palestine and to move Palestinians closer to achieving sovereignty and liberation rather than, you know, what you described as sort of this wasted energy on these elections?
Well, I think there has to be a sort of decentralization or sort of we have to take away the focus from the PA. The PA is not a representational body. It was very much a service providing body that was created by the Oslo Accords. And so I think the importance of the PA, the focus on the PA has to be, worn down. Like, it's not our representative body. The PLO is supposed to be the body that represents all Palestinians where they might be, and it has been totally subsumed by the PA and by Abbas and his cronies. And so really, you know, I don't have the answer to that question because I think it's so broad, but the answer, you know, we can't look for the answer within PA elections. We're not going to find liberation, true democratic representation within the PA or within the current political institutions. I think we also have to demand of this current leadership, we have to demand that they step down. They are neither representative nor are they doing the Palestinian people any favors. In fact, you know, they're incredibly an incredibly corrupt body that is doing more damage to the Palestinian cause. And so it's not an easy question to answer. And I think unfortunately these elections are a sort of a distraction so that people don't think about or don't come together to really think about what should be done instead.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Open the door. Seek new world. In here, Security 90.3 FM from Montreal.